This is WBCN, Boston.
In Boston, Massachusetts, where she lives.
Please come to Boston for the springtime.
People say in Boston, even beans do it.
Boston, 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 back up to Boston.
Boston at last.
He may ride forever neath the streets of Boston.
Boston, if you please, Massachusetts.
Boston, Massachusetts.
Sweet things from Boston.
Boston!
Boston rocks!
Boston rocks!
Boston rocks!
But they'll be rocking in Boston.
From Stockbridge to Boston.
On the blue blood streets of Boston.
Body foul, body bopping foul.
Frisco to the Apple to Seattle, back.
Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana.
Bring back the Boston back.
There was something in the air. There always is in Boston.
We only got one last thing to ask in Boston.
You heard of the Boston Monkey?
Well, you heard about the Boston.
Boston, you're my own.
Boston is the home of the four-letter word that means rock. WBCN.
It hit the airwaves in 68.
You're listening to WMFO 91.5 FM on your radio dial, WMFO.org web streaming. And here we are at the campus of Tufts University in Medford, Mass. Today, first our co-host,
Aaron.
And I'm Mike. And our guest today, you must know him from his long, great history in the Boston rock scene. He started in WTBS, which is MIT, later turned to WMBR, then went over to the big leagues at WBCN.
I'm having a flashback.
There you go. And then on to WZLX and iHeartRadio. It is our pleasure to have in the studio...
Well, Carter Allen.
Hey, Carter.
Hey, great to be here. Thank you. Good job, Jenny. You guys did great.
Thank you very
much. Aretha Franklin. Nice.
Thanks.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. Well, thanks for inviting me here. This is great. Thank you very much. I love the studio, and I'm so glad you didn't get rid of all your vinyl. There's so many vinyl records here. It's what a radio station is to me.
Yes.
You
know? Yes.
And it's been a while since BCN. You know, there's been no vinyl in any stations I've worked at, which is too bad.
Yeah. It seems to be the trend. We're one of the few stations that kept our vinyl.
And you should, because you know everybody's going to start throwing it away, and it's going to be gone, and no one's going to have it.
Well, the problem is that some of the tapes from the bands have either disappeared or disintegrated. And even if they have all those songs, they were going to release them, they're not going to release every song.
Right.
So if you had a catalog of a certain band, like, say, Slade, we have all their songs.
I suppose the ultimate compliment would be if a band comes back to you and says, you know, we need to release some of our songs in this compilation. We can't find them. Yeah. And you would be the source of that, you know, which is great to do. Sometimes
some bands do look for clean copies of their vinyl.
Yeah.
So, anyways, as me and Aaron were talking earlier, one of the reasons why you're here, you're an author of 5 books.
Yeah.
And 2 on U2.
Yeah.
And 1 on the Decibel Diaries.
That's a new one. Yep.
And the Rise and Fall of BCN. And there's a 5th one.
Well, there was a book about Dinky Dawson.
That's a Dinky Dawson.
Super roadie. Nobody bought that one, but it was a fun book to write.
Yeah.
Dinky is actually, he worked for Fleetwood Mac, and he did some work with Jay Giles and Steely Dan, most famously. And he had a book, and my publisher said, could you help him out with it? And so we kind of hammered it into a 300-page book. And it's actually a fun book, but like I said, it came and went.
You were there in the beginning of the explosion in the Boston music scene. As we played earlier, we played YouTube. There was a European band, but the Cars and a bunch of the bands.
Yeah.
How special was that time with the bands and radio?
Yeah. Well, you know, when you've been in it for as long as I have, you go through a lot of different eras and musical movements, if you will. And that's still my favorite time. That time between, they say, 1977 and 1985, that time then. Just to watch the bands in Boston... working in a small series of clubs, you know, Cantones and the Rat and the club over in Cambridge and other clubs gradually adding in, getting better at their craft, bringing people in. Suddenly they've got a crowd at the show. So the club owners keep booking them and they're making some money so they can actually go in a studio and make a halfway decent recording. And then you're talking albums or singles. And then pretty soon the national record label started looking in on Boston, and so many of them got plucked. So it was great to watch that scene grow for all the right reasons and show me that, you know, if everybody's into it for the right reasons and is not out to make a killing, right, you can really build something special. And it was really special for a long time. And it's still special looking back on it.
Yeah. So what brought you into radio? What did you listen to growing up that made you say, you know, I want to do that?
I just, you know, I enjoyed, you know, some people are really into sports. Kids are into sports. I was into sports. I played, you know, baseball, Little League and all that. But my friends and I, we were in, you know, junior high and high school. We were really into music. Like we would really, we'd go to the record store, and record stores were great then, and they're still around. You got to look and, you know, hard to find, but you would go in there, you'd be able to, like, hey, what does this sound like? And give it to them, and they'd play it on the system, and you could hear stuff. And so I would go out and discover, like, a new band, Deep Purple. You know, I go, this band is great, man. And I played for my friend Bob, you know, who lived up the street, and we were out in the middle of nowhere. And so I just got into music, and radio for me was an extension of wanting to share the musical discoveries I was making. And over time, I realized it was great to be able to play music from new up-and-coming bands because you could build excitement for what they were doing, become part of their story, or help them out. So really, just a desire to share the music. I got into radio because of music. I didn't get into radio to be a DJ, which I came in from a totally, I mean, it's almost a foreign way to do it now because there are very few stations that promote the music first. It's all personality. When I got in, you know, into radio and in college radio, I could do what I wanted. Back in that time, BCN was looking for music guys that knew music. You didn't have to be a DJ. You didn't have to be great at it. You didn't have to have a great voice. So they hired me because I knew about music. You know, I ran into the program director down at the RAT one night. We started talking about AC/DC, which was a band nobody knew about then. He's like, wow, you know about AC/DC? And pretty soon we're like doing like what I used to do with Bob when I was a kid, talking music, and then boom, you got had a job doing it. So yeah, all those great reasons.
But those are the right reasons.
Yeah, and I've been lucky enough to be able to, like, I was at BCN until 98, and I left by choice, and I went to ZLX, and ZLX was very much a BCN-like station back then. Over time, people are more into hearing the hit format, but it's okay. That's what it was. You still have a chance to expose some music here and there. So I still enjoy myself, and I still do.
So as you were exploring up-and-coming music and bands and going out and seeing them, any stories of bands that everybody knows about that you helped get on their way?
Well, I guess U2 would be the most obvious story. Yeah, that was... Well, the U2 story, every time I tell it, people don't believe it because it just, you know, it's they built out of Boston, and I was working at a record store in Kenmore Square, New England Music City, which has been long gone, and we were listening to, I was working with Greg Reedman.
Yeah.
Greg Reedman and I, we were opening up a box of imports, and there was a couple singles. There's a Echo and the Bunnymen single, and there's this band U2, and it's like, wow, what's this? A Day Without Me. What is this song? So he listened to it, and it's like, wow, it's really cool. It's really good. It reminds me actually of a Led Zeppelin, the middle guitar break reminded me of a Jimmy Page guitar solo. I'm like, wow, it's kind of like, it's pretty well recorded. So I took it on TBS, and I started playing that song. And then over at BCN, they were open enough that if you brought a song from outside of the radio station and the music director listened to it, he goes, yeah, this is great. Sure, play this. And I was on the overnight, midnight. So I started playing it on BCN. And I'm trying to make a long story short, they came to town as a warm-up band for a Detroit group, which is long forgotten, a Baruga Bandit.
Okay.
And so they started getting some play on BCN. I had an import album, gave it to BCN, and we started playing it in regular rotation. And it was... people started coming. People came to that show. And after they got done warming up for Baruga, everybody left. Mm. And Baruga played to 40 people. It was that dramatic. And then the band just built and built and built. So it was just great to be involved at the very beginning. And meeting them the first night, when they're not even old enough to be in a club,
yeah,
you know, they got to be escorted in by the manager, who was just barely old enough to be in a club. So that was probably, you know, the earliest. And then getting involved in some of the big Boston bands, you know, like, I mean, on a local level, like the Neighborhoods, you know, playing the Neighborhoods from their first demo, playing like Mission to Burma when they just had a tape out, you know, groups like that. Those are, it's just great to be involved in that. And there's, you know, and not, there's so many other people that get involved, and there's a lot of luck too, because people say, oh, you know, you worked with you too. Well, I played a lot of bands, but things have to work. A lot of parts have to, and a lot of luck has to happen for that band to go on and become famous. But yeah, those are some examples.
Also, you've done many interviews over a long period of time. So
I've been glad enough. I'm glad to have been around for a long time.
So who would you say are your favorite, and who would you say is your least favorite interview?
Probably favorite, Pete Townsend. Pete Townsend's a wonderful interview because he, you know, you're first of all, you know, you get a little, it's not nervousness, it's just anxious. You're like, oh, you want it to come, you want to do this interview. And he's just into it. I mean, the worst interviews are ones where the people don't care. They show up and it's like, you're taking precious time from their day, and you can feel it, and there's tension in the studio, or it's that it impressed me, I've done, you know, or they've been on the road and they're burned out. But Townsend genuinely wants to do an interview, and he likes to explain things. Like when he's talking about a song, he will explain it. When he wants to talk about what Tommy means to, he will take the time to explain it. So he's a great interview. Bono's a great interview. Any of the guys in U2 are great to interview for the same reason. They're really into their music. Any band that's into music, I love to interview because we have a connection. A band that's, you know, maybe just all flash and no substance, I might have trouble with. I remember having a hard time with Billy Squire at one point, but I think I just caught him at a bad time because I interviewed him a year ago and he was great, you know. So you know, finding some people. And then there was an artist that I never mentioned because most people don't know of her, but Kate Bush. She is an English star, and she did a 1979 tour and freaked out and never toured again. And she kept putting out amazing albums. I call her like the female Peter Gabriel.
Okay.
She has that progressive, she's a genius. And her music is great. I got to interview her, and I flew down to New York to interview her. They gave her some Valiums and put her on the Concorde.
Oh, gee.
Flew her over to New York, so she, you know, before she knew what was happening, she was there. And they worked her doing like 4 or 5 days of interviews for her album Hounds of Love, which she did have a hit single, Running Up That Hill. Anyway, interviewing her was just amazing because she was so sweet. And it's so rare because she never stepped foot in America except for that time. That was a great interview. I very rarely had terrible interviews, you know, with people. Sometimes, you know, maybe you're just not on the same wavelength. I'm trying to think of a particularly bad one. Rick Nielsen from Cheap Trick, he could be a pain. Yeah, he's tedious.
I heard him getting fistfights with other musicians.
Yeah. You know, I guess, you know, you just catch them at a wrong time, or maybe they've been on a 200-date tour and they're just toast. Yeah, Rick Nielsen was, I actually interviewed him and didn't even use the interview. And another one was Stephen Stills. Stephen can be great, you know, but he went through his phases where he was totally like, you know, coked out of his mind and all that. And I guess I got one of those, and he was just impatient, wouldn't suffer. He was, didn't want to be bothered.
Yeah.
And I was into it. You know, I you know, if they're trying to promote something,
yeah,
I go with it. I bring up the record, or I bring up the book or the box set or whatever it is. It's not like I'm playing along. It's their newest thing. You want to talk about it, you know? In fact, that's the best thing to do when you're talking, I think, to an artist, is to talk about their new stuff and not bury it. And they open right up to you because they want to talk about that. And once they've talked about that, then they love to talk about other things. Once they get to know you, you know, they'll open up.
You were, you know, during the Boston explosion and stuff like that, and there was a lot of small victories, big victories, and probably some disappointment with record labels. Could you see any of that coming, where there was great bands that were going to put out great stuff, and then the labels let them go adrift?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the big examples was the Stompers.
Yeah.
Stompers were a great band.
I saw them
They still are a great band.
Yeah, I saw them in La Peste at Inman Square Men's Bar, and they were the finalists. La Peste won.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's that. Yeah, La Peste was a great band, too.
Oh, yeah.
Those guys were. I actually went, I kind of reached a career. I just was going nowhere in the summer of 78, and I decided to hitchhike over to L.A. And make some stops along the way. And the band gave me a stack of La Peste singles to sprinkle across the United States, you know, so I was taking them to places, which was cool. The La Peste, you know, had a good shot, but then Peter Dayton decided to move on.
Yeah.
The band that followed, La Peste continued on replacing
him. Stevens, yeah.
Even Stevens, that was a great band,
yes.
too. It was disappointing they didn't get a shot.
Well, it's kind of... I believe there was a lot of interest because Rick Ocasek was behind the one
right.
with Peter Dayton,
right.
and Greg Hawks and the Cars was contributing, and I imagine labels were looking at them, and Peter and the rest of the band had like a little disagreement about music, and he went off to do his own solo career.
Right.
But the second version of La Peste was looked at by a record label. They were going to get signed, but they signed a band on Island Records. They signed U2 instead.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't it weird, that weird coincidence?
That is a weird coincidence. I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah.
Back to your original question, Stompers, it was too bad. Those guys actually worked hard and put out a pretty decent
yes.
album.
Yeah.
And then a record label went out of business. You know,
it happened to the Atlantics. It happened
yep.
to Private Lightning.
Yep.
The list goes on and on and on.
Yeah, I don't think Private Lightning was really happy with their first album.
No, they weren't. Adam Sherman told me that the label wanted them to be the next Blondie, and they said we were the late farthest thing from Blondie.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I remember talking to Adam about it a long time ago, and it's like sort of getting in the studio and your music being taken from you, you
yeah.
know, by a producer, just sort of, you know, taken in a different direction and you not having really much say at all.
He said that basically the other band on that label, A&M, was the Police.
Right.
And he said it sucked all the oxygen out of the room.
Yeah. Yeah, the Police had to work hard too, but yeah. Yeah, those are a couple of big examples of bands I wish, you know, especially in the Atlantics. You know, that was too bad about the Atlantics.
Yeah.
And they put out some of their best music after their ABC
yes.
contract,
yes.
you know.
So, studio performances is that you've had bands in to perform. Your favorite?
Wow. Yeah, not much at ZLX. I mean, we never did too much at ZLX in studio, but BCN did them all the time. I mean, we did live broadcasts into Paradise all the time, too. I remember, you know, John Mellencamp getting his band in the studio with, I don't know how we got like 25, 30 people in winners, contest winners to hang out with him. And he was great. And a real classic band. I remember Jethro Tull came in like in 93. They were on Mark Parenteau's show, and they were awesome. You know, they were into it. You know, a band that's really into it and takes the time, does a sound check before we get on the air. Those are a couple of really good performances I loved in the studio.
And what about, I mean, when you and I first met each other, you did the opening for, that's good, Victor Wainwright.
Yeah, yeah, but at Nine Wallace.
Nine Wallace, which,
yeah.
I mean, you know, the Van Nesses have, because I walked in there and I saw your poster for your book and turned around to Peter and said, Peter, I've been trying to find and meet Carter Allen and have him on my show. And he said, turn around. And you were right there.
Right there.
Right there.
Yeah.
And
was that a Bonnie Tyler song?
Right there.
So, going out and seeing bands that you've over the years, what's your favorite show that you ever went to and the one that you did not enjoy or did not appreciate?
I would probably say for the best show or the most memorable would be seeing Roger Waters at the Berlin Wall in 1990. I've seen Roger Waters a number of the times, and I saw Pink Floyd a couple times. But that show was such a intersection of events, with the Berlin Wall coming down the winter before and was still coming down. And East Germans were able to come across to West Berlin, and they were looking around. It was like the summer of love over there. It was like everybody was, you know, freaking out at how the freedom of being able to come over. And we took a tour and went over to East Berlin, and it was all browns and grays and blacks and whites and downcast eyes, and but people were like starting to flow back and forth, and you could still like go up to pieces, to sections of the Berlin Wall and chip yourself off a piece. Anyway, Roger Waters had a show of Unity, which was performing The Wall with his band and guest artists, like Cyndi Lauper, and Sinead O'Connor was part of that, and the band and the Hooters, and lots of people. And so the concert itself was just so special because we had like bleachers, and I was reporting for 7 or 8 CBS radio stations in America, so I had a press pass, and we got flown over there. And when you fly over to Berlin, you still had to fly through one of the narrow air lanes because you fly through East Germany to get to Berlin. And we landed at Berlin Airport, so you just can't, you know, you just have this Berlin airlift thing in your mind, you know, and there's all this history that's, you look every direction. And the concert was at Potsdamer Platz, which is right on one side of the arc. I can't think of the big monument. It'll come back to me, but there's a monument right on the east-west line in Berlin.
Yeah.
And that's where Berlin, that's where Hitler's bunker was, in this area of no man's land. And the Berlin Wall went right down the middle of Berlin, but at this area, it opened up into this huge area of no man's land that you could fit 250,000 people in. It was that big. And there were still unexploded bombs and mines that had been left there because it was a killing field, you know? And they were still pulling bombs and mines out of that ground 3 or 4 weeks before the concert. And the show went on, and it was, you know, a lot of people have had a chance to see The Wall since because Waters has toured it and come through Boston a bunch of times. But at that point, it hadn't been staged since Pink Floyd did it for the last time in 81. So that was special, plus the fact that it was at the Berlin Wall. You know, the wall is psychological, but it actually applied to the physical separation. So there's all these things going on, and to stand up and see, like, the East Germans, like the East German soldiers pulling the tanks and armored personnel carriers up to the wall and standing on top and dancing, you know, it's like, and when the show was over, it's like, wow, the Iron Curtain has fallen.
Yeah.
The world's a great place. Peace, you know, for at least for a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
It really felt great. But that would have to be the best just because it was a great performance. Sinead O'Connor screwed up pretty bad. If anybody ever bought the CD or the DVD or whatever, they had to stay at the end of the concert and reshoot her scene because she screwed up. She got nervous and forgot the words.
Wow.
And if you watch the DVD really close, it's the late afternoon, early evening.
Yeah.
You can see the light. And when you get to her part, it becomes dark,
yeah,
and it comes back to light. So they kind of shoot it really close. So that was one of the best, if not the best. Yeah, that'd be the best. You know, seeing The Who do Tommy and Quadrophenia, those are great shows. Peter Gabriel, every time I see Peter Gabriel, he's got something new. He's just so creative. I mean, I saw him at the Paradise. He was amazing then. We were in there. It was a Halloween night, and we're in there, and we're sitting, and he brought the band in through the front entrance to the back of the audience, and had black lights all over, and they're all like done up in black light paint, you know, playing drums. Tony Levin, the bass player with a big bald head, is all like painted day glow.
Yeah.
It was great. And then he played worked his way up, played the Orpheum. He walked out into the audience on the armrests of the seats. I mean, not many artists will do that.
Yeah.
He played the Centrum. It's the first time I ever saw anybody lay back onto the audience and be supported by the audience. First time I ever saw that.
Yeah.
And then the last time I saw him at the Garden, he was up, you know, he had a round stage and he belted off and they were walking upside down under the lighting truss. I mean, and the music is just so challenging and great.
Yeah.
So as far as disappointing shows, I don't know. I remember seeing, you know, I like everybody. I mean, even if they're uncool to certain people. Like, I saw Greg Lake because when I was a kid, I really liked prog rock when I was growing up, and Emerson, Lake and Palmer were a serious band.
And they originally came from the Nice.
Keith Emerson did. Yeah, and Greg Lake was King Crimson, and Carl Palmer was in Atomic Rooster.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, you might back. Actually, you might have an Atomic Rooster in these albums here.
Probably someplace.
There's thousands of them. But Greg Lake did a tour, and he played the Wilbur, and I was just, this is, I don't know, 7-8 years ago, maybe 9 years ago. And he was way overweight. And it's really disappointing to me because he could have just played guitar, but he played all these cheesy backing tracks and stuff, and it did kind of a storyteller's thing. And I didn't realize it, but he had cancer at the time.
Oh, that's too bad.
And he had probably done, he was doing like crazy steroids, and so he gained all this weight. And I was really disappointed at that show for a long time until he passed away and I got the backstory on that. And I just, you know, felt sad, you know, but... You know, there's a value, I think, to get out of just about every show you go to. Even if a band plays badly, it's almost like a point that you reference from when they come back and they play a great show. Well, what was going on? You know, what was wrong? Were they arguing? Were they screaming? I remember seeing Fleetwood Mac shows where they were just, they sucked. It's like, this is Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like they were in a bad night, and you got Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham shooting daggers at each other, pissed.
Yeah.
It's like these guys, then it's almost like they're only on stage for the money, and then magic goes out of it.
Supposedly, Lindsey is not involved in this last tour.
Yes, that's true. It's going to be Mike Campbell on guitar and Tim Finn from Crowded House on vocals. Which, I mean, if you look at Fleetwood Mac's long history, which is one of the longest.
Started with Peter Green. Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac. Yeah.
They have replaced and added people all along. It's just that Stevie and Lindsey are the most famous lineup. He chose not to do it. He's back out doing his own thing. He'll be here, I don't know exactly when, but they put tickets on sale for the Wilbur.
So,
of the people who we've lost over the years, who would you have liked to have met and interviewed, and then on the other side, who's still with us, would you like to still have the opportunity to meet and have a conversation with?
Well, I've met Bowie 3 times, but I never got to interview him. I would have loved to interview Bowie. I'd probably have been nervous, but he was not like that. He was just really very warm. I mean, I'm sure there was times back in the Ziggy days when he was high when he could have been weird, but generally, through his whole life, he was very giving. I met him a bunch of times, and then very close up and shaking hands. In fact, there was one time when he played, which at the time I believe it was still Sullivan Stadium.
Yeah,
he did the Glass Spider tour, and so I'm trying to think what year that was. Probably 87, 88, maybe. And he wanted a local band to warm up in each market, and so he became quite fond of the neighborhoods. Let's think about it, David Bowie. And he was always listening to music. I think the most successful musicians are always listening to music. They just love music. And so he requested the neighborhoods to warm up for them. So the neighborhoods did their set in Sullivan Stadium, and BCM was doing a live broadcast, and we had ultimate access. So we were backstage broadcasting. We were walking around and doing stuff, which doesn't often happen. And all of a sudden, it's still late afternoon. The limo shows. The limo arrives backstage, and just everything gets electric. Mm. Even for the guys that are, you know, the roadies that do this all the time, David Bowie's in the house. Mm. And David Bowie gets out of his limo, and you know he's unmistakable. He gets out, and I'm about 30 feet away, 40 feet away, just minding my own business. And all he's looking around, and he looks right at me. He just like looks at me and keeps looking at me. And I'm like, and he starts walking towards me. And I'm like, wow, whoa. I figured, you know, you do one of those look behind you to see who he's really looking at things. No, Bowie's looking at me. I don't really know Bowie. There's absolutely no reason why he should be recognize me. He comes up to me and he sticks out his hand and goes, David Minahan, nice to meet you. He thought I was David Minahan. I guess we have the same haircut or had at the time. And so now I'm like really embarrassed for him. So I said, No, I'm Carter Allen. I work at WBCN. And he kind of got embarrassed. He said, "Oh, I'm so sorry." I go, "But I know David. I can take you to him." And so chose the way out. Okay, so he's following me now, and I'm going over to the neighborhood's trailer. They got a trailer backstage where they've got, like, they're working their way through two cases of beer. And they're in there, knocking the door. David Minahan sticks his head out. Hey, Carter! Hey, someone wants to meet you. And they look at David Bowie, and the eyes just, you know? So I got to introduce the neighborhoods to David Bowie. But, yeah, I would have loved to have interviewed him. He was just... just so much to talk about, you know, so much depth, so what a creative spirit in all ways. And someone who I would like to interview that is still alive.
That you haven't had the opportunity to do.
Yeah, I mean, I've interviewed the guys in Led Zeppelin on the phone. I would love to do a sit down with Robert Plant. Like, I've interviewed him three times on the phone, and he's easy to interview because he's into music. He loves music. Anybody who's into music, I find easy to interview. But I'd love to sit down and talk with him. You know, just like, you know, have like records spread all out over the place. The first time I interviewed Robert Plant, I didn't know he was calling. No one told me he was calling. I was on the air at BCN. It was after Live Aid, and the phone rings, and this voice, this English voice, goes, "This is Carter Allen." I go, "Yes." "Robert is going to call in 5 minutes." I go, "Okay." So I'm thinking it could be Plant or Palmer, right? And maybe someone else. I was like, "Robert who?" And he goes, "Robert Plant, of course." Click.
Yeah.
And then the phone rings again. It was Robert Plant. So there was an interview for one of his albums. And I think it was Shaken and Stirred. That was the album, the third album. And... he was delighted. So no preparation. So it's just, you're just going to, sometimes those are the best interviews, yeah. You know? And he was just so easy to talk to. So we're talking about Live Aid. He hated Live Aid. Yeah. He hated their performance. He said, "We weren't ready. Jimmy was out of tone, this and that." So he got that off his chest. We talked about his new album. And then he takes the initiative in the interview and starts talking about, "I love Boston. I love the music scene you have there." He starts like, he goes, "The last time I was there, friend, someone took me down to Harvard Square and I saw the Tarbox Ramblers. They were amazing." And I go, "And the Del Fuegos." And this is when the Del Fuegos only had like, one or two singles out. This is before Warner Brothers. This is 85. I'm like, "Robert Plant knows about the Del Fuegos. How wicked cool is that?" So that was great. So I'd love to sit him down. I'm trying to think of someone else that is still alive that I would love to talk to. Boy, of course I'll think, you know, I'd love to sit down with anybody in Pearl Jam, but, you know, especially, you know, I mean, any of those guys. They're just great, you know.
Fred Pineau from the Atlantics told me his encounter with Jimmy Page.
Yeah.
And they were touring, and they doing some type of showcase in New York City, and they'd opened for rock. They were opening for Roxy Music. And there was an after party, and Fred notices Jimmy's off in the car in the party. So he goes up and goes, "Hey, I just want to say, you know, I'm a big hero of mine. I love your stuff, you know." And Jimmy does turn around and goes, "You know, we're in the first band that opened for Roxy Music." He goes, "I didn't like your band at all."
Oh.
He goes, "What do you say after that?" He goes, "Oh, I'm sorry, you know." Yeah.
Well, maybe that's the producer of Jimmy Page, but he could have been a little more
diplomatic.
You know, maybe the thing to do then, because you always think about what you should have done in hindsight, would be to, "Well, you're the producer. What should we have done?"
Yeah, you know?
But see, that's crazy, because with the Atlantics, there were always a little bit of Yardbirds in the Atlantics.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, so why didn't Jimmy see that? But
You have this book about BCN Radio Free Boston. I saw your cohort there, Charles Lacordaire, a few months back.
Sorry to hear that.
He shook my hand. He didn't want to let it go. That was kind of awkward.
Were you at his thing at the Paradise?
Yes, I was.
Yeah.
Actually, we had talked there.
Yeah, that was fun. That was a fun night.
I was a little curious if you could explain to the listeners the importance we had on BCN. You had a local hours on Sunday night, I believe.
Yeah.
And you also had drive time, and there was always a struggle, maybe you could highlight a little bit, about bands wanting to get not just on the local hour, but getting that drive time.
Yeah. Well, the good thing is that some bands did get the drive time, which was great. It wasn't like there wasn't going to ever happen. It happened a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when I got to BCN, I was doing local music on TBS, but it was part of the scene, so it was easy. We were playing all kinds of local music. When I got to BCN, it wasn't really a job for me, except to be on the air at midnight to 6 on Saturdays and then do fill-ins. And so they needed Maxanne, who had left, who had been the last person to handle local music, and she left.
And she broke some people, too.
Yeah, she did. She went with the Cars, Billy Squire, Aerosmith. Yeah. My God. Not much had been done. You know, Oedipus was over there a year and a half before me.
Yeah.
In fact, when he moved up, I moved into his old slot. That's how I got my start. So he had his own local music that he brought over and played on his show on at BCN. But there was no, like, there was a cart rack that hadn't been touched in years in the Air studio.
Yeah.
You know, they had some of the commercials in there, some of the, you know, special performances on cartridges.
Yeah, the people don't understand. They look like an 8-track.
Right.
And basically, you know, the DJs, you know, do a PSA or commercial, boom, right into the slot.
Right. And there was some local music in there, but it hadn't been updated in years. So I volunteered to do that. And so that began my time working in the local music department. On Sunday nights, we used to have office hours, if you will, on the listener line, where bands would send us reel-to-reels or whatever, and we would listen to them, and then they would call us, and we'd critique. And that eventually became the local music, you know, Boston Emissions on BCN, which was great. Now, not anybody, but it was wide open for local music, specific, so a lot of bands would get on there. But then there was, you know, you'd want to cross your band over into WBCN's regular rotation.
Yeah.
And it had to be good enough for, you know, not a disinterested listener, but it had to measure up to, like, a Roxy Music song.
Yeah.
It had to have something special to it.
Yeah.
You know, the recording quality had to be somewhat together to get on mainstream. I used to tell bands, like, if you are a group that has a really well-trodden musical story, like you're doing a song that sounds like the Cars, or you're doing a song that sounds like, you know, the Yardbirds, okay, you've got to kind of compete with them. But if you've got a unique sound, it's a lot easier to get on the radio on BCN because it's unique. It's like, you know, when you have Planet Street doing General Hospital is a different thing, or the Mission of Burma, you know, that's when I reach for my revolver, or Academy Fight Song before that. It's a really different sounding song, so it stood out. So, and the recording was really good. So those songs would get onto mainstream, onto Drive Time.
Yeah, great.
And in the same way, you know, Mark Pereno, when he got the comedians on his comedy slot after 5 o'clock, five past the big hour, 5 o'clock, that's when they kind of crossed over.
Yeah.
So how did you find it enhanced or detracted from the music, MTV?
Well, actually,
I know we had VH1 first here in Boston before MTV came out.
We had
V66.
V66.
Yeah, I don't know. I believe that MTV was here before V66, and V66 was an alternative to that. I'm pretty sure.
I lived in Framingham, so it was easy to get.
Right, yeah. But it was the same time.
Yes.
V66 was a product of believing that was the way everything was going to go. And it was a great, valid experiment and a lot of fun for the people that were involved in that. But I think V66, and in the national sense, MTV, because V66 was local, was a tremendous boost for the music scene. Because the music business was in a recession in 79. A lot of those bands, all those great skinny tie bands were coming out, but records weren't selling. Or some of them were, but not everything. You were getting some bands like Blondie, you know, crossing over and having big hits. But, you know, it was tough. And MTV got a lot of new faces on, you know, in front of people. And they didn't have a lot of videos in the early days. So it wasn't like the old school performers like, you know, Queen or Led Zeppelin or the big bands that were around at the time were actually getting on MTV because they had nothing to play by them. So, you know, you're getting the Buggles and, you know, Pat Benatar and John Mellencamp, you know, groups like that. And, some of the early, like, Stones got pretty hit pretty quick, got some clips out, so they got on MTV. But it was a tremendous shot for the business. You know, it diversified the scene out so that the new wave scene could kind of come in. So in the long run, it helped.
Wasn't there a Channel 5 Live at Night program for a while featuring local bands?
Yeah, it didn't last long.
Yeah. I think the neighborhoods and
Five All Night,
yeah.
Live All Night.
Yeah.
And that was with Matt Siegel.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Danny Schechter.
Okay.
And Matt Siegel was at BCN. A lot of people don't believe that because they know he's been at KISS for so many years.
Yeah.
He got hired at BCN back in like 78.
I think because Charles quit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, Charles went off to do illicit drugs,
yeah.
and so they were looking for a morning guy,
yeah.
And the program director remembered Matt Siegel from Arizona and got a hold of him, and they connected, and he got the morning show, and then Charles came back, and so Matt ended up in middays, and that's where Michigas started. But anyway, Matt Siegel eventually left with Danny Schechter to do this Live All Night show. So with Danny Schechter involved, it was... political, there were political issues, and there were also musical bands that came in. And it all ended one night when they did a special on punk rock and Human Sexual Response with the performers.
Oh, they did the...
They did But...
F song, yeah.
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 So they did that song, but they weren't supposed to do that song.
Yeah.
What happened was they actually... The show was tightly planned.
Yeah.
They knew what songs that HSR were going to do.
Yeah.
And they were clean songs because this was a live TV show.
Yeah.
And they ran early, so they asked the band to go out and play some music while they ran the credits.
Oh.
And then, so the band did that song.
Yeah.
And nobody was paying much attention because, hey, it's the end of another show.
Yeah.
And they're all like, you know, taking the headphones off and, you know, here we go. And, you know, and then somebody noticed what was actually on TV.
Yeah.
And it was just, there's a lot of obscenities in that song. I mean, it's a really, I mean, it's a special about punk rock that they were doing. It was a really punk thing to do.
Yeah.
And so there's not a lot of people up. You would think that the people that would be up would be okay with it.
Yeah.
But there were several complaints.
Yeah.
And so the show got canned.
Yeah.
You know, the next couple of days later.
You're listening to What's Happening here at WMFO in Medford. I'm Aaron.
I'm Mike.
I'm Carter Allen.
And so what brought you into, 'cause we know about the music, what brought you into writing?
Writing. Well, yeah, I think it's, I went to college, well, I went to college to be a pure science major and be a marine biologist. Mm-hmm. That was my first year. I failed miserably. Mm-hmm. I was good in biology, but I couldn't cut the calculus.
You succeeded. You ended up in Boston, which is right on the ocean.
Right. I was in Miami, then I came up to New Hampshire and then ended up in Boston. Mm-hmm. But I became, my major was English. And a mixed major with music. And I kind of, so I moved to Boston to get a job at the Globe. That's what I wanted. That was my target, was to be the music critic at the Globe. Well, they already had Steve Morse, and Steve Morse is a pretty damn good writer.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't get a job there, and I tried other magazines. I ended up writing for, you know, local magazines like Pop Top and What's New and Sweet Potato and Boston Rock.
Yeah.
And even wrote for some national magazines. Okay. But I always wanted to be a writer. That's why I ended up in Boston. Mm-hmm. Radio was, you know, I was here and I was painting houses. And a friend of mine who went to MIT told me, you know, MIT, they have this radio station. They can't get enough DJs because the students are more into other stuff, you know, building missile systems or whatever, or computers. Yeah. And so I found a job over there just for fun. And that's where I met the guys at BCN, and you know, it's just, you luck out. You're available. It's and bands would tell you this. It's just being on top of someone's mind.
Yeah,
and it's like, you know, suddenly there's an empty. The first person you think of is the person you call.
Yeah.
So the first person Tony Berardini thought of, the program director, was Carter Allen. So he gave me a call, and I thought it was to get a job in the music department because that's what I was trying to. He said, no, we want to try out on the radio. So I was trying to get a job in writing. I couldn't get it, and I got a job in radio. It just happened. So years later, you know, I went through this marvelous story with U2, growing as they grew, going on the road with them for fun, seeing them grow as a band and become the artist that they were by the Joshua Tree. And I said, you know, I'd love to write this story. So I started writing and working on it, finished a book, finished the whole thing, took it to an agent They helped me polish it up a little bit, and then they found a publisher. And it was a big hit, especially overseas.
Yeah.
And so that gives you good confidence. Yeah. And then I got hooked up to do the Dinky Dawson book. And then that was in 98. And then I got involved at ZLX, and there was a lot more work there for me. And so I didn't write again until I polished up another U2 book. And then the WBCN book. I was a publisher, had read the U2 book. And they said, you know, this is when BCN went out of business in 2009. I said, we'd love it if you'd write a BCN book. And I was like, wow. And so that's how I ended up doing that one. And a new one, Decibel Diaries, which is, you know, a story about 50 concerts I've been to. So I just love writing. Mm. It's not easy finding the time to write. I have to write in the morning before I go to work. You know, from 5 to 8 in the morning is when I used to write. But now I'm going to work at 6 in the morning because I have to drive from west of the city to Medford. So I don't know when I'm going to write it. Another one. We'll see.
Yeah.
It's fun. You know what? I love writing. And writing about music for me is not hard, but finding the right thing to write, you know, to write about. The subject is tough. It has to be something that you're willing to give power over your life, because you give a book power over your life, just like these musicians give a project power over their lives, and it can make you feel great, but it also makes you feel miserable.
Yeah.
You know, you want to write, you do some amazing writing one day, and then you got to stop and go to work.
Mm.
You know, then you feel lousy because you had to interrupt yourself, and then you'll have another day where you don't write well at all, you write gibberish, and then you got to go to work, and you're like, ah, you know, you weren't able to get into a better place.
Mm.
So you can make yourself crazy, but that's what it does.
So when you sit down to write, what is your favorite place to sit down and write?
My office. I got a little office in my house. My little trailer out in the Metro West. You know, a little double wide. So we always tell everybody. Yeah, that's a great place to write. And, you know, you just get to a point. In the morning, my thoughts are clear.
Yeah.
Coming home from work, it's a little tougher because you got everything going through your head, mostly Boston traffic.
So do you sit down and at the computer, or do you sit down and write out some notes ahead of time to get your thoughts down and then process to go, or do you do it the other way around?
I work at the computer. although I've been working on a novel, which is harder, much harder. and I went on vacation, and I couldn't take the computer with me. And I found value in writing out longhand because it's like, well, I got to make this a little better because or else I got to erase it or scratch it all out and start again. And my wrist hurts because it's always out of practice because we all tap in a computer. Mm-hmm. So I found a value in that. And then sitting somewhere nice on a lake with a pad of paper, some thoughts really come through.
Do you find, since you've done that, because with a computer, you can hit the key and lose everything, but if you have it down on paper before you do it, you can look back on what you may have wanted to write or something to bring up later in the story.
Yeah, you get better at archiving your stuff. A lot of times, you know, I get little snippets of ideas and I put them in a notes section on my phone, and then I transfer them over. It took once when I was writing the U2 book, I lost 2 months of writing. And it was my stupid mistake when I was backing up because I had two copies of the book. I'd have one on me and one in the computer. In case the computer crashed, I would have the copy. I was backing up and I backed from the backup over to the computer. Idiot. And as soon as I pushed the button, I went, oh my God, I just screwed up. And then I was like frantic, and I realized I lost 2 months of work. Mm. So from that point on, I developed three backups. The original backup's in your computer. One backup travels with you. The other backup is at the radio station at work. And then I would interchange them and back up. So you never lost anything. But yeah, it's a fear. It's a fear.
See, I always found when I sit down to write, and this is just that I'll sit down and write, and then no matter what I write, no matter how good it is, I have to cross it out and start over again.
Right.
And because it just doesn't feel right. It's like you may pull something back out of it, but I just have to What about yourself?
Totally. I mean, it's been really rough with this novel I've been working on.
Any hints on what the novel's about?
It's about my family, but it's based in truth, but it's a novel because I wasn't inside some of the members of my family's heads to tell exactly what they were feeling. So I'm going to write it as a novel. And it's very difficult, and I respect people that can write like that. You know, it's amazing. But the degree of scratching out what I've done is out of control. Because I'll write something which I think is great and then come back 3-4 days later and go, this is rubbish. And or you have a whole new idea or something you can add. So what I've done, though, is I save the stuff that you might, like if you write it out in longhand and then scratch it out or ball it up and throw it into the fireplace, that's maybe not so good. It's good to keep your old stuff. You know, your mistakes, it's or what you think of as a mistake, because sometimes you go back and you find some value in that. You know, I mean, artists are like that. You know, that's why some artists have such a hard time finishing albums. They keep second-guessing themselves or adding things. That's why U2 has such a hard time finishing an album. They can start an album, but they can't finish it.
Yeah.
And you need someone, like a producer that you can trust, or you're on an unshakable deadline that you have to finish this thing, where you'll finally stop trying to improve yourself, because ultimately you can get into that twister of not ever being able to finish because you keep thinking you can do better, and the next day you keep doing better, and you never end.
Yeah.
You know?
I wonder if you can give us a quick overview of the 5 books, just a little snippet in each. Feel that the listeners know what is involved in each book.
Yeah, Outside is America, the original book about U2, takes them from, it's their American story, from first hearing them to right around the Octoon Baby period. The second book I wrote was The Rock and Roll Adventures, Life on the Road, The Rock and Roll Adventures of Dinky Dawson. Mm-hmm. That book is hard to find, but you can probably find it on eBay. It's not actively in print anymore. That is a book that Dinky Dawson is the roadie who is the star. Mm-hmm. Colorful, English, super roadie from the 60s, amazing life. He's the star interacting with all of these great bands, most notably Steely Dan, Jay Giles Band, and Fleetwood Mac, the early Fleetwood Mac with Peter Green. Mm-hmm. That book's out of print, but it's a fun book. It's one of my favorite. I mean, it's one of my favorites. Yeah. And then after that was The Road to Pop, which is the U2 book, which is an update on the U2 book, which has extra chapters and took it up and past the Octoon Baby era. Then there's Radio Free Boston, A Rise and Fall, WBCN, which is about that great station, which I interviewed 100 people. I got to meet all the people that were there before me, and I got to become better friends with the people that were there after me, like Adam 12 and guys like that, and Hardy, and people I didn't really know, which I interviewed, and who were into it like I was into it, even though it was later. And they were carrying on the mission of a great radio station. And there's a lot of great radio stations, just that's my old station. And then the new book is The Decibel Diaries. It's the journey through rock and 50 concerts. It's everything from, you know, seeing someone totally classic like Ted Nugent to seeing, Robert Plant, you know, and Alison Krauss, you know. That's great. So that's the latest, you know, 50. It goes up to Joe. It starts off with the James Gang back in the day and ends up with Joe Walsh, who was in James Gang in 2015. You know, it's got Jack White in there, and it's got Pearl Jam and seeing Nirvana out at the old Wallace Civic Center.
Where can people get your book?
They can get it at Amazon.com, or they can get it at, you know, a lot of the local stores. You know, Barnes & Noble carries it. Done a lot of book signings for those guys. And they might want to call because it's been out for a year. So sometimes it's in, sometimes it isn't. But you can always get it on Amazon.
What are your hours on the air?
I'm on ZLX from 10 to 2, Monday through Friday. And I have a new show, which the radio station liked my book, and they gave me a show called The Decibel Diaries, which runs Sunday nights 10 to midnight. And that is collections of my old interviews and memories and some of the, like tonight on that show, we start off with an interview I did this past week with Steve Perry from Journey, who has not been seen or heard from in 20 years. He's coming out with his new album, and I interviewed him this Tuesday, and it was a joy. He's such a great person. That interview, and then there's a little tribute to Led Zeppelin, because it's 50 years ago this week was the anniversary of their first rehearsal.
Okay.
When they did Train Kept the Rollin'. And then the end of it is an hour-long tribute to Brad Delp that WZLX produced a day after he took his life.
Yeah.
And it's because this is the anniversary of the, what's today's date? The 19th,
yes.
August 19th, 2007 was the concert for Brad at the Pavilion, where Boston and Godsmack and Extreme, RTZ, Ernie Automatics, Fahrenheit, they all played in honor of Brad Delp. And so I do that tonight. So that's a fun show to do.
Yeah.
The Blues Show, which I did for 19 years, has been canceled. But hey, 19 years is pretty good for a
good run.
Yeah, so I can't complain.
Could we ask a favor?
Sure.
I have two promos I wish you would allow you to do.
Sure.
If you would, please.
And we pass this over to Carter Allen.
Ah, okay. This is Carter Allen. You better be listening to What's Happening. This is Carter Allen. You're listening to WMFO Medford Legendary Station. Yeah.
Thank you.
MFO's been around for a long time, and just keep doing what you're doing, because free radio should never be silenced.
And you and I spoke about this because I do a blues show.
Yep.
And I've invited Carter Allen on the blues show to co-host and bring the best of your blues.
Oh, I could do that. How long is the show?
Could 3 hours.
3 hours. That's cool. Yeah, I would love to do that.
Absolutely.
I got to know a lot of great people in the blues scene, and in the same way where it was great to be working with some of those Boston bands in the early days, it was great to work with the blues bands because they all need help, because it's not a mainstream format, and these amazing performers playing these tiny places, and if you get into it, you can see some great music for not a whole lot of money and right up close in front.
Well, thank you, Carter Allen, for coming in today. I've been listening to you for years, from the old days of WTBS to now. We thank you very much for coming in and sharing your stories with us today.
It's been a lot of fun. Thanks.
And we'll see you again soon. Everybody should listen to you tonight.
Yeah, I will.
This is WMFO in Medford.